From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Pittsburgh, California.
Oh, I'm not from the Bay Area.
Pinole, California.
San Jose.
I'm from Paradise, California, up north.
Coming up, women are learning what to do and say if they're attacked on the street. Then we'll hear about the 56th annual San Francisco International Film Festival with the Film Society's new boss, Ted Hope.
People only retain 10% of the knowledge from what they read, but 65% from what they see.
And we head towards the water for this week's Audiograph Sound. Put your guessing hats on. It's Cross Currents. Stolen smartphones have become a big black market business. Around the world, a reported 26 million phones were stolen last year. And here in San Francisco, cell phone thievery makes up half of all crimes, according to Police Chief Greg Sir. District Attorney George Gascon has called for a so-called kill switch for cell phones because the
value of the phone could be completely eliminated if you put a kill switch on it, so that as soon as the phone gets reported stolen, the phone will no longer be operable.
Kill switches already exist on phones in Australia and the UK. But for now in the US, phone theft is profitable. And it's not just robbery that's making residents of target areas like San Francisco's Mission District uneasy. An attempted rape near 23rd and Guerrero Streets earlier this year reminded neighbors of how important it is to continually raise awareness around this issue.
For me, it just means that we always have to think about this. And not that to try to make people feel like they never have any safety, but this needs to be an issue that's always there.
Janelle White is the executive director of San Francisco Women Against Rape. Her organization hosts an annual walk to raise awareness around the issue. It's happening this Saturday.
I think it's important to annually organize ourselves and make sure that people are consciously thinking about sexual assault consistently.
That kind of consistent awareness is key to the self-defense trainings at Impact Bay Area. The nonprofit teaches that even verbally arming yourself can help you scare off an attacker.
Leave me alone. I don't understand. The San Police are following me. Go away. No! No!
KALW's Mary Willis went to a recent training in San Jose and brought back this story.
This might sound like a street brawl, but don't worry, everyone in this fight is safe. 8 women have just finished 22 hours of self-defense training with Impact Bay Area. Each is demonstrating what she's learned to a small crowd of family and friends. A student is fighting one of the 3 male instructors who are dressed in large cushioned suits and padded football helmets. That's so the students can use their full force against them. The idea is to make the simulated attacks as realistic as possible, to the point that the instructor says disarming comments to the student so she learns not to be intimidated. On the sidelines, family members watch as their loved ones go through a very real-looking and sounding attack. The crowd is told to expect this and resist the urge to jump in, especially anyone carrying a gun. That's right, they are explicitly told not to use them.
Back off! Good job, Kate.
The only female instructor today is Jenny Williams.
They call me the whistle instructor, so I am the one who teaches the women the techniques and is on the mat with the student, helping them coach each time.
Williams is a 4th-degree black belt in karate. She says she appreciates that women in this class can use their full force to protect themselves, But she says using the voice is just as important.
Most men that attack women are not looking for a fight, so just that verbal stopping of the attack and showing some resistance is enough to stop the attack in itself.
And I noticed you've got your hands up in front of you. Why is that?
Because we are, we call it the ready stance. And what it is, it's kind of doing a universal stop sign. It's not a karate bring it on kind of position, but more neutral, hand both palms out in front of you, making it very clear that I don't want you to come any closer.
I ask her to demonstrate a few defensive moves.
First, I'm going to use my voice to let him know that I don't want him near me. You need to back up. Leave me alone. Go away. This man is bothering me. No! No!
As she yells no, she's using the palm of her hand to strike the attacker's nose and her knee to strike the groin.
Then I will go for help immediately, and that could be a police, a friend, a parent, a sister, a brother, whoever it is for you, but you want to immediately get help and support.
Williams says with the proper techniques, a woman can deliver a knockout blow to her attacker.
And not only that, but our suited instructors are trained to interpret whether it was a knockout blow. And during our fights, during the class, our simulated fights, they don't go out unless they have really received a knockout blow. And then we will whistle and I will say, okay, now they're out, this fight is stopped, and then they will run to safety.
But there's one more step.
The ending is to pull you back into the present moment and to drop you into your body.
Parisa Shelton is co-owner of the Morning Crane Centre where the class is being held. This last step is more of a note to self, to look around and assess where you are.
In case the fight starts on the sidewalk and because of the adrenaline and the tunnel vision, you end up in the street. You just want to be aware of your surroundings and what's going on.
This weekend, Shelton was also a student. She says in the past she had problems with setting boundaries, but today she's learned.
It's okay to set boundaries, and that by saying no, if I don't want something, saying no to that person is like saying yes to myself.
Anne Sunderland is also finishing her training today. She's from Oakland, and she says she was recently robbed.
I actually saw my attackers approach, and I sort of froze, and I didn't know what to do. And then obviously, you know, I'm okay, but it was obviously a situation I wanted some training on how to either avoid or deal with it if it happened again.
Sunderland says the main message she's taking away from the course is to trust her instincts if she's ever attacked again.
God forbid if I'm ever in a situation where it becomes physical, I feel like I have the tools to have a fighting chance.
But Sunderland says this doesn't mean she can let her guard down when walking on the street.
You know, unfortunately, I feel like I have to be constantly aware, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. But what has really been hit home to me is I can't ever be on the phone. I can't ever be listening to music. I just have to be always very aware of my surroundings. So I don't know if it's necessarily feeling unsafe. I just know I can't be oblivious.
Maybe that's the simplest self-defense tactic of all. In San Jose, I'm Mary Willis for Cross Currents.
In observation of Sexual Assault Awareness Month, San Francisco Women Against Rape is holding a walk on Saturday, starting at the Women's Building in the Mission District. For more information, go to kalw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney. And now we'll move to a different kind of drama, the kind that takes place on the silver screen.
Midge, you remember a fellow in college by the name of Gavin Elster?
Gavin Elster?
That's a funny name.
You think I would? No.
I had a call from Gavin today. It's funny, he sort of dropped out of sight during the war. Somebody said he went east. I guess he's back. Mission number.
Well, it's Skid Row, isn't it?
Tonight is opening night for the San Francisco International Film Festival. The longest-running film fest in the Americas is in its 56th year, and this is its first run under the executive direction of film producer Ted Hope, the new head of the San Francisco Film Society. Hope produced or executive produced 69 films over a span of 4 decades, including American Splendor, 21 Grams, and In the Bedroom. He's considered by many to be a father of the independent film movement in the U.S., He came by our studios to talk with KALW's Hannah Baba about independent films and what's in store at this year's festival.
At the beginning, I just wanted to make movies that felt emotionally true, that connected about the world we were living in, right? That had a minimal amount of artifice, or if it had artifice, to call attention to that. Audiences, artists, and technology change far faster than business or markets do. You know, so we keep using the same infrastructure to deliver the movies that we love most, yet it's completely changed. So that we're in this era where the whole industry is shifting from a mass market audience, where we have to make movies that please everybody, to niche audiences, where we can go hyper-targeted focus to people, find the movies that specifically speak to them. And at the same time, because, you know, it's no longer, it used to be a U.S.-dominated system, 50,000 films are generated on a global basis per year, right? Feature films from all over the world. And that's kind of, it's wonderful, but it's also overwhelming. And it starts to point out the real need and necessity for film festivals, because you need somebody like the San Francisco International Film Festival, which was the first film festival. It's the longest running film festival in the Americas, and it's always focused on world cinema, to find what is that best menu from all those 50,000 films and bring them to audiences on a local basis.
So let's take some films that are tied to the Bay Area, and we'll talk about one film, which is Google and the World Brain by Ben Lewis, about the people trying to stop Google from carrying out its Google Books plan to scan every book in the world. So let's hear a clip. This is where the filmmakers travel to Spain, to Catalonia, Spain, and they're telling a librarian there about Google's project.
The Association of American Publishers has filed a lawsuit against Google, alleging the internet company's plan to scan and digitally distribute the text of major library collections would violate copyright protections.
I think the issue of copyright is an archaic, unproductive view. When you create something, you're building on the work of other people, no matter who you are, whether you're J.K. Rowling or Shakespeare. You're basing your work on the work of others. You're basically taking their ideas. Artist does not own their ideas. No artist does.
Any useful information exists because of the efforts of real people. And copyright is our way of remembering who those people are. And it's crucial to not lose that. And I think cyber culture is missing the point of copyright. You might say, well, who cares about authors? Let a few authors not make as much money as they would have. But it's a precedent. The whole internet will become a tool for the concentration of power, and that would be a disaster.
That's a clip from Google and the World Brain, a film showing as part of the 56th annual San Francisco International Film Festival. You can see it on April 27th at New People Cinema in San Francisco and on May 5th at Sundance Kabuki Cinemas, also in the city. So, Ted, in this film, they're trying to explain to people that what Google is doing is essentially rendering knowledge that was acquired over thousands of years obsolete by digitizing libraries, you know, book collections, all obsolete for commercial gain. What's the power of a film like this, you know, especially for us here in the Bay Area, where Google is in our backyard, and chances are many Google workers are listening to us right now and may go see that film?
Well, I think it's the power of any film in particular to spark conversation, that movies, you know, are kind of like those trees that fall in the forest. You know, unless we gather around them to have that conversation, we don't know what they are. You know, to be able to present a movie like Google and the World Brain here in this community, you know that ideas will be shared. That's what you want from a film festival. To be able to do it in a public context with where we give a forum for that conversation, that's fantastic. You know, I'm truly excited by all of the documentaries we have that. You see kind of firsthand how they have the power to elicit change. Movies are essentially just that launch pad for us. They're an easy way to engage. You know, I've always been impressed with the statistic. I think that people only retain 10% of the knowledge from what they read, but 65% from what they see. And I think that with these films, along with several others that we're showing that are, you know, those movies aren't. We have other films that, frankly, will be even more controversial for audiences. And I think that that at times some films will be polarizing. At some times films will be placating, you know, and just how they come to work with our emotions and kind of spur us on to gather more knowledge for ourselves is the key thing.
Mm. Another film is by Dan Krause, Bay Area-based director known for films like The Death of Kevin Carter and Life 2.0. The film showing at the festival is The Kill Team, and it's about a group of five soldiers, U.S. soldiers, who were accused of killing Afghan civilians in Afghanistan. Here's a clip.
The trial's finally here. I'm pleading guilty to involuntary manslaughter. My other charges of premeditated murder and conspiracy are being dropped.
The Army is just wanting to, you know, make this all go away, and they're trying to drop it down to the lowest common denominator. You know, they want the lowest guys to pay for it. There's nobody been charged, you know, staff sergeant or below, and that's it. There's no officers have any responsibility for anything. It's huge. This thing is big. It's bigger than Adam. It's bigger than me. It's bigger than everybody right now.
Best case scenario, the judge awards me time served, and I'd walk out with my family that day. Worst case, I get an 8-year sentence.
If Adam would have went to somebody out there, he would have been dead. He would have came home in a body bag, if we were lucky. Because, you know, Gibbs had threatened him that he would cut him up in a million pieces and throw him to the wild dog packs out there, and nobody would ever find him. The only remnants he would have would be Adam's finger on his necklace that he was making of body parts.
That's a clip from the film The Kill Team by local director Dan Krause, a film about U.S. soldiers stationed in Afghanistan back in 2009 who were convicted of murdering innocent civilians. You can see it as part of the 56th annual San Francisco International Film Festival on April 26th at the Berkeley Art Museum and Pacific Film Archive at UC Berkeley. And there are more dates if you just check the website, festival.sffs.org. That's interesting to say on the radio because an F sounds like an S. But go to our website, klw.org, and you'll find it. Ted, I found it a deeply disturbing story. It had me kind of tense and on edge the whole time. Is this what a good film is supposed to do?
I think people, audiences always want different things from different movies. And one of the roles that a film festival can play is to help place it in a proper context and allow you to have an experience that goes beyond the film. So it is definitely a film that people should enter the theater with a little bit of knowledge about. It's also a film that we all need to think quite a bit about the issues that are involved. You know, as a young person in today's world, people don't have that many options in front of them. The military, you know, is one of the ones that's frankly spends a great deal of effort recruiting people to come join. The arts can't compete, you know, in that way. And people frequently don't know what they're getting into when they sign up. You know, it doesn't line up always with those advertisements. It's important to be able to have that kind of first-hand, first-person accounting of what goes down in that those situations.
Favorite film of all time? Please answer it. Yeah. I know it's tempting to say, oh, I don't have one favorite movie.
Well, it is that to begin with, in that, you know, movies speak to us based on the context of the time that we watch them, right? So I certainly can say, like, what was the most influential movie for me? And that's in kind of in a constant battle, I think, from Taxi Driver to Clockwork Orange. But that's because I saw those films at age 15 and 16, you know, where I'm establishing my identity, you know, shaping my aesthetics, feeling in conflict with the world as those characters in those movies do, and trying to figure out how the hell I'm going to express myself going forward. So that definitely connected. I think that I look at often the viewing experience that I have and what was the most engaging of those. Being in the cinema, I happened to go the opening day at matinee show of Schindler's List in Chelsea, New York. And the 4 o'clock show is the senior citizen show. And I just thought I was sitting with a bunch of old people. And when the movie started to end, people started to stand up and stand still. And I realized I was in a room full of Holocaust survivors. And it was chilling and moving to see the connection that movie made for them. The other was just this past winter, at Sundance with Ryan Coogler's film Fruitvale, a film that the Film Society put up 25% of the money on. And it was so moving because the film is about Oscar Grant's killing, the young man who was killed on the Fruitvale subway platform on New Year's that sparked all the riots and all of that. And it was such a heartfelt story that captured that community, captured that young man. And a lot of Oscar's family were at the screening, and they stood up afterwards and kind of testified about how accurate this was and what it meant to see his life portrayed in this way. It was chilling. I was sitting in front of Oscar's aunt, and when she told that story, it just was like, this is why we make movies. This is why the struggle to get them made, to get them seen is so important. And it was just moved. So I can't say like those are my favorite movies, but those are my favorite experiences that have motivated me to do what I do.
That's San Francisco Film Society Executive Director Ted Hope speaking with KALW's Hanna Baba. The 56th Annual San Francisco International Film Festival starts tonight with the film What Maisie Knew, playing at the Castro Theater at 7 o'clock. Find the full schedule and where to get tickets at KALW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney. And now we'll leave the movie theater and head south on Highway 1 to a place that's the answer to our weekly sonic treasure hunt, Audiograph. All week long on KALW, we've been playing you this sound. We asked you what you think it is and where in the Bay Area it's from. KALW's Julie Kane brings us the answer.
I'm Jeff Boysen, one of the docents out here at Honor Nuevo, and this is a good viewing area because you can look north and up the entire beach to see the elephant seals. This time of year we have the females who gave birth in early December coming back to do their molting, and that's where they're going to shed their fur and get new fur. We also have the pups that were weaned, that we call weaners, that are still here. And they'll be here until their body fat drops. And then nature says you need to go out and start foraging for food. I think the most amazing fact with the elephant seals is that when they are on land, they're fasting the entire time. And then when they do go back out into the open waters, they tend to take the same route every time, year after year.
Where do they go from here? What's their route? Do you know?
The males typically head up towards the Aleutian Islands. The females tend to like squid, and they head out more in a westerly direction. They go out about 1,600 miles and then come back.
Many of you called in with great guesses, and your calls made us realize you can hear this sound in a lot of different places in the Bay Area, not just out at Año Nuevo. So we picked this week's winner because he recognized that these were the calls of wieners. Congratulations, Jeffrey Gray. We'll be sending you a KALW t-shirt. For the rest of you, there'll be another contest next week. In the meantime, go to KALW.org to hear more from Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. And that does it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Julie Kane, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Nina Gensler-Debs, Alex Kaminsky, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Christina Loring, Daphne Ann Matsiaraki, Seth Samuel, Stephen Short, RJ Sloan, and Christine Stelakis. Today's show is engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thanks to you, we're listener-supported radio. The percussive sound you're hearing now comes from the Kurt Moore Quartet. They're playing this Sunday at Nick's Restaurant on Rockaway Beach in Pacifica. Music starts at 4 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney.